I think when you talk about collaboration for data teams, you're thinking about collaboration within the team, which is, of course, very important. No data effort is a single person effort. So you are going to need multiple hands on deck within any data team. But there's also the collaboration, obviously, of data teams with their org outside of them, so that that team can make their data initiatives discoverable and align them with that org's like main metrics and objectives, right?
Welcome to the Data Bytes podcast. Megan, how has your day been so far?
It's been great for a Monday. I can't ask for much more. And I'm happy to be here joining you on this conversation, Zadie.
Happy to have you. I know we got connected, I think, initially through LinkedIn, and then you slowly get connected on all the other platforms like Instagram. And we had a great conversation because you've been starting to do some more keynotes. I think you just did one this past week. How did it go?
Not necessarily a keynote, but it was just like a talk. And it was still good practice for the public speaking skills that I very much need to develop. And as usual with these talks, I always dread it leading up to it. And I'm just like, nobody's going to listen to what I want to say. Like, why did I sign myself up for this? And then afterward, got a lot of great feedback. People connected with me. And they were like, really enjoyed your talk. And I was like, okay, it was worth it. And so like, that's the cycle of me doing talks these days. It's like, I dread it up until the moment of, and then you get through it. And then afterward, people, you're like, okay, like this was fun and I learned a lot. And I also got to practice a skill that I really want to work on in the new year. So I think it was a win-win, but I definitely do not do as many talks as you do. So you are definitely my inspiration there.
Thank you. I think you're headed on the perfect path though, which is just keep doing it and putting yourself out there. And then you realize, especially afterward, when people have such positive things to say, that there aren't as many things to be fearful of as we first anticipate. But I think individuals may be surprised that even you get nervous for talks because you produce so much content and you have a very successful class on LinkedIn Learning on SQL for Finance. So tell me a little bit more about this class, SQL for Finance, because I think you have over 100,000 individuals who have taken this class, correct?
Yeah, which is kind of a surprise for me. When I first recorded that course, it was like a year and a half ago. I was like, nobody's gonna take this course. Like, SQL for Finance is a very niche topic, because at least my experience in the finance world, I was mostly in spreadsheets at the time. And so it wasn't until towards the end of my time as a financial analyst that we started bringing in more advanced tools like, I don't know, Power BI, Tableau, using some SQL here and there. And so that course was created out of me wishing I had access to SQL, to build financial models, to analyze the, like, to build models to value companies in mergers and acquisition processes. That was my job. But I didn't have SQL back then, and I didn't learn SQL until after my time as a financial analyst. So that course was kind of me wishing that I could have gone back in time to tell myself, hey, you could do it this way. And so, yeah, I thought it was a very like niche topic. And once I put it out there, a lot of people, turns out, wanted to learn about this very specific application of financial data. And I think it was because it was niche that it, I guess, did so well, because there weren't other courses like that out there at the time. And so that was really my first foray into course creation. And I had a lot of help from the LinkedIn Learning team. And they left the, like, they made it so that they did all the work around making the course pretty, distributing it, promoting it. And so All I had to do was really just the scripting and like the recording during the week when I was in Carpinteria, where their studios are. But that process itself was also something that I didn't know required so much work. Like, turns out you have to do a lot of research, even though like you generally know about the topic. To be able to teach a topic requires you to learn about it in a totally different way than probably when you first originally were exposed to it. So course creation is a very underrated process that I'm so glad I learned through that experience of creating this course. And now a year later, I am starting the process to add a couple of amendments to the course to sort of answer some questions that people had about, you know, what are some further applications? How do we set this part up? And so just addressing a lot of the common questions that came up in the Q&A. So excited to like start adding to the course and making it even better.
Yes, I think courses where you're teaching to your younger self always end up to be the best courses. I know when I taught my SQL for data science course, it was like, man, I wish somebody would have taught me this way at the beginning, and it would have helped, because it really puts yourself in the position of the learner. And you're exactly right. It takes so much work to create a course. And even though you know the subject, you do a lot of research because you want to bring the most valuable content to the learner and just to cross-reference. And that's why I always say that to teach is to learn, because you're spending all that time in a way learning yourself in the process of teaching. So tell me a little bit more about what's included in this course. Obviously, it's SQL for Finance. We know that. But what are some of the things that you go through in the course?
Yeah. So it's broken up into two sections. It's like this course assumes that as a finance professional, you were not taught like database design concepts and querying concepts as part of like your formal education. So the first part of the course goes into the fundamentals of learning SQL, so that it can set up for how you can apply those concepts specifically to a finance setting. And so in that second part where you're applying it to the finance setting, we also go through some real world examples of that I gathered from interviewing people who are in the finance sector and have used SQL in their day-to-day, because I personally did not have that experience when I was a financial analyst. So had to go out there and gather some market research from professionals who did. And so that second half of the course is really dedicated to like sharing the stories of how people in the real world working in finance are using SQL to build out their forecasting models, how they are doing more advanced things like building out quant models, things like that. It touches very like briefly on those more advanced topics, but I'm hoping with this amendment to the course, we can really beef that up. So this course follows the idea that you can't just learn topics in isolation or in a vacuum. They only have value when you can apply them to real world applications. And so this course really tries to do that with hands-on exercises, downloadable files, so that you can play around with the data yourself and like really go above and beyond in wrapping your head around the concepts that are taught and learning it with learning styles that you're that are best suited for you. That's how I would break down the course. And it's been a while since I've like actually gone through the weeds of everything that is highlighted there. But yeah, I'm sure once I add the amendments, I'm starting like end of this month to like add a couple of more videos. I will be in the depths of exactly like everything that was contained in that course.
Yes, and that is one of the funny things about creating these online courses, is you spend all this time at once creating the content for it and diving into it. And then it just kind of goes on and lives forever, right? And you're like, it may have been a year or a couple of years since you dove into it. Sounds like you're refreshing the course now, but it is funny how these things live in their own little world, which is fantastic. One of the things you mentioned was how important it is to see how others are working and collaboration, particularly within data science teams? I know this is an area you're really passionate about. What made you interested, or was there a moment in your career where you realized collaboration is essential, particularly for data science teams?
Yeah, I think I realized how important this concept was when I did a reflection on the types of data roles that I've had. And these types of data roles have spanned the spectrum of like how data driven they are. I've worked at companies where like using data was like not important. And then I've worked in companies where data is very much embedded into every single decision that is made. It's deeply embedded into our culture. And so having been in roles that span that spectrum, I understand some of the pain points of why some companies don't care about it. Unfortunately, like, you know, in this day and age, everybody's talking about data-driven this, data-driven that, like AI everything, right? And you would be surprised how many companies still kind of like treat data as this like black box. And so, yeah, I've been in companies and teams where that has been the case. And I know that that type of company is still very common. And so to bridge that gap between like my experiences being in companies where data is very much the lifeblood of everything that we do, I needed to like reconcile those experiences. And so I'm like, okay, I kind of progressed from being in this one type of team all the way to like this team that's on the opposite end of the spectrum. And so I've realized that like collaboration is this very fluffy sounding topic, but ultimately it was that key differentiator between those companies where they didn't care about data and like companies now that I work for where it is very like a very important aspect of everything that we do every day. So yeah, collaboration is that answer.
Yeah, it's interesting that you notice the correlation between those who were successful working with data and those who were, and that key was collaboration. So when you talk about collaboration with data science teams, or should we say data teams in general, right? It's probably more data engineering and data product management, et cetera. Who is it that they are collaborating with, or who should be that starting point that they're collaborating with?
Yeah, I think when you talk about collaboration for data teams, you're thinking about collaboration within the team, which is, of course, very important. No data effort is a single person effort. So you are going to need multiple hands on deck within any data team. But there's also the collaboration, obviously, of data teams with their org outside of them, so that team can make their data initiatives discoverable and align them with that org's main metrics and objectives, right? That data team has to first convince the rest of the organization that what they are doing and what they are pursuing is one and the same as what the company is pursuing. But then there's like a third layer to that too, which is the outside org being able to communicate back to that data team. And that's like the hardest part because people who are not sitting in those data teams might not have the data literacy, might have completely different tools, or like might not even care to want to communicate back to that data team. They might think that this data science team is doing like some voodoo magic in some like dark room somewhere. And so like what they do does not concern us. And so like that data science team, they can communicate all they want to people who sit outside of their team. But if that outside team does not want to communicate back and create that like two-way channel of communication, that like those efforts are still futile. And so what the term that I'm thinking of here is citizen data scientists. And how I define that is just people who are not traditionally trained. They had not been trained to be data scientists formally, but they have to interact with data and understand data science principles as part of their everyday jobs. And we are now seeing the rise of these citizen data scientist roles who don't have a title containing the word data anywhere, but they still have to interact with data every day. Like marketing teams are very much like that. Operations teams are very much like that because of the proliferation of data. And so I did say that, yes, there are a lot of companies who don't care about data, but there are also a growing number of companies who acknowledge that it is important to use data-driven decision-making. And they are starting to hire more of these roles where you are expected to be data literate and have familiarity with like what data can do for these outside teams. And so the key to enabling that two-way communication between traditional data teams and everyone outside of them is really giving resources to citizen data scientists so that they can be data literate and so that they can communicate back with those data science teams that are embedded throughout the organization.
So if you're on a team where, let's say, there isn't a lot of collaboration between what you would call the citizen data scientists and the data science teams, what would you recommend for an individual who is on the data science team who wants to do that collaboration, but it's not maybe supported as much from the executive level? How do you begin to start that? Is it possible, or do you need to find a new job at a new company where that is already supportive?
Yeah, I think that answer comes down to the very vast amount of data tools that are out there. You hear often in the conversation of the modern data stack, it's like the sentiment is to have a tool for like literally everything. When in fact, I think that that can be counterproductive in promoting that two-way collaboration and communication between pure data scientists and citizen data scientists. Because if these two types of teams are speaking in different languages and using very different tooling, they're always going to be like talking past each other. And so turning to tools that bridge that gap and provide an interface or like a platform where these two parties can use their native language together and still communicate is how I think we solve that problem. And so at DeepNote, what we're trying to do is create a notebook to be able to do that. And so how our notebooks do that is, you know, you have your regular data science notebook where data scientists can go and do their thing, which is code in the notebook interface. But also that notebook has to be mapped to a layer that those business stakeholders and citizen data scientists understand. Because they could not be bothered to like sift through all hundreds and hundreds of lines of your code, right? You have to present your findings in a format that they understand and that they care to look at. And so like when you think about traditional tools like dashboards, right? Those dashboards are very nice and pretty, very understandable for those business stakeholders, but the problem with dashboards is that often they are used one time, and once your business stakeholders get what they need out of it, they're just like, okay, this dashboard is done. And so the data scientist and the data analyst who spent hundreds of hours of their time on this dashboard, like, that's just gone to waste, right? And so with notebooks, we really find it to be that perfect medium where like you have the presentation layer that is a perfect reflection of this work that data scientists are doing that is a constant effort. Like it's a medium where you can gather your thoughts and contextualize the data in addition to analyzing the data. And so the app interface that sits on top of the notebook interface is our answer to how we bridge the languages of business stakeholders who want to see like an interactive app that they can play with and they can get the high level insights from the technical aspect, which is the notebooks that the data scientists are used to. And so yeah, my answer is like the tools that we that we're using. And in this day and age, there's like tools for everything, but not everything is the right choice for your organization. So yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like tools are a great place to start because it provides us this common, I would say maybe language, right, to communicate and to derive insights from and collaborate with. But it really does take that first initiative for individuals to be able to put it out there, to talk to other people. You know, I think we often say that like tools are great to assist in the work, but they aren't going to solve your problem if you first don't have that initial desire to reach out to the marketing teams or the operation teams or finance teams as well. One of the things that I see from just kind of your career trajectory is you played multiple roles. Would you say that has helped you in better collaborating with people, having gone from different departments and roles to understand maybe somebody's perspective? So you did strategy and transitions at EY, and then we're a senior associate at data and analytics strategy, and then a data scientist, and now a developer advocate. You know, how has that kind of shaped your perspective on collaboration, just the different roles that you played throughout your career?
I am very thankful for all those very different roles that I've had. And those different roles have not only exposed me to different skill sets, different industries, but also, as I mentioned before, like different levels of exposure to like using data as part of your everyday work. Like I said, when I was a financial analyst, it was like everything was in spreadsheets, and it's like we only used a fraction of those spreadsheets. And so it was not data driven at all. But having that as like having started out my career in that role, it gave me empathy for the people who are not traditionally it gave me empathy for how people who are not traditionally trained to be data scientists or data analysts, like how they think about the other side of data, which is like not necessarily the technical components of it, but like what should be the end use case of data and information. And so coming from that background, it gave me empathy for what it's like for people who like who aren't in the weeds of the data, but like they still need to use data as part of their jobs. And so when I became when I was a senior associate at this other consulting company, where that was my first data role, I was working with people who were like me in my first role, who like didn't know what data was, but they needed to have like their data stack set up, or they needed like to do this one analysis for like a project, a ginormous project that they had. And so having the empathy that I had developed from that previous role, I'm like, okay, I know that this kind of persona will care about XYZ and they will not care about ABC. As I progressed in my career, I took that empathy with me because like you interact with those people all the time. Like you as a data person, you have to serve those personas who ultimately, unfortunately, don't really care about the weeds of your analysis. They want that high level takeaway and what it means for them. And so that's where that empathy piece that I got from my first role as a financial analyst really served me.
Yeah, I think that is one of the things that I have learned so much from playing different roles, is it allows you to put yourself in someone else's shoes, which is exactly what empathy is, right? To be able to understand something from somebody else's perspective. And I think we would all get a lot further if we are a little bit more empathetic to ourselves and to one another. And so I think it's just a good reminder to individuals, like, don't worry about changing careers or different roles, because you never know how those are going to come back in time and help you and assist you in what you're doing here today.
Yeah, I think I say that to career transitioners all the time, that the roles that you had before the transition are also so important to that ultimate transition. Like I used to think that my finance background served me no purpose when I was trying to pivot into data. But that's not true. It's like every single step that you've had in your career path, you can probably pull out some learnings from it and use it in your roles after your pivot.
Exactly. I'm curious what your thoughts are in terms of the new tools that we're seeing with AI. Do you think these tools are going to assist us in collaboration? Because, you know, at the end of the day, we're all starting to have our own AI assistant. How do you see this evolving in terms of how data science teams evolve and how they start to work with other citizen data scientists?
Yeah, I think that these AI tools are really going to drive up the productivity of those citizen data scientists, particularly to bring them up to the same level as the pure traditionally trained data scientists. And so we see in our product, DeepNote, we started introducing our own AI features, and it was particularly the people who were like more junior or like people who were not the data scientists in our customers' companies who were reaching out and giving us positive feedback about our like Copilot tool or our AI assistant tool, where we could type in a regular prompt and ask it to like generate a whole notebook to run the instructions that you've given it. So it was people who were like more junior in these roles who are like, this has really helped me in elevating my Python skills or helped me in being able to collaborate with my seniors who are already like very great at Python. These junior folks were finding that they were using these tools to like at least give them the head start to be able to like to be able to like enter more like deep work within their projects. And so it's like I think people who are very advanced in who are like very advanced data scientists, they might brush this off because they're like, oh, I already like know all that I need to do my day-to-day job, right? But they're going to be the ones who are like slower to adopt it, whereas more junior people in their careers, they're going to be the ones who are embracing it. And ultimately, like that's what's going to get them up to the level of those regular data scientists. And so as a whole, AI tooling, I think, is really going to elevate the industry because we're now going to be starting with this baseline where everybody can be like, hey, I just need this AI tool to like give me a head start on like starting this analysis or like starting to write this blog post. Like that's what I use, right? And so ultimately, I don't think it's going to replace any professionals in this field. It's just going to give them that leg up. And over time, it's kind of going to be like a tide that like floats all boats and elevates everybody to this higher baseline.
Yeah, I love that analogy of a tide that raises all ships, right? And I think it's really an exciting time to work in this space because it means we're going to have more people to collaborate with, and there's no need to gatekeep or to hold true to like the work you do, because as we all know in this field, there's plenty of work that needs to happen with data, and it's only going to become more important in the world of AI. As we start to wrap up here today, is there one piece of advice you would give to either your younger self or to other women who are working in technology?
Yeah, it's to really advocate for yourself. And that kind of advocacy can come in a lot of different forms. And what that means to me is like, honestly, like tooting your own horn, making your work public, building in public, and like being transparent about your learning journey. I think a lot of people are very hesitant to do that because women naturally don't want to toot their own horns, or like they, or like, you know, they feel like they're being egotistical or asking people to like, I don't know, I feel like women naturally are more selfless. And so they're not going to want to do that. And I think building in public and building my personal brand in public is absolutely what has led me to the opportunities that I have today. And looking back, if you were to ask me just like 2 years ago if I thought that I would be sitting here in a podcast with you, like absolutely not. And I would have never even imagined that putting yourself out there in public and like being vulnerable as to like where you are in your learning journey and bringing people along in your learning journey could have led to that. And so I think it's great because you are putting yourself in the driver's seat of crafting your own narrative, because if you don't, nobody else will. And along the way, you will meet so many people who are trying to do the same thing, and you're going to meet a lot of like-minded individuals who are just as willing to push you up as they are for themselves. So there are just so many there are so many residual benefits to creating your personal brand out there in the public, and that is definitely like my number one piece of advice that I give to like anybody who's starting out their career. And I will say, I think I'm still pretty early in my career. And so I'm super grateful that I have started in this process early on, because I think the benefits are like exponential, just like investing, right? So the earlier you do it, the more the benefits compound on themselves, and like the more people you'll meet, the more opportunities will present themselves to you. But you have to like put yourself out there in the first place, which I understand is super nerve-wracking, but it gets easier over time, as with like any skill.
Yeah, I really love what you say, which is build in public, because I think so often we think like to put ourselves out there or to like build our brand, we have to be at this level of an expert, or we have to be finished and it has to be done. And when you say build in public, it means like, no, from the beginning steps of like, hey, I'm learning this or I'm starting this. And it's really that vulnerability that I think also attracts people to you and helps you find people who are the right match for you, because you're talking about where you are at this moment in time, right? You're not trying to be something else or do anything else. It's just being real and genuine. But that is, I think, what makes it more scary, because when we're very honest and real and genuine and vulnerable, that's when it has the opportunity to potentially hurt, right? If we have a sense of rejection or don't get the response that we're looking for. But I love what you say, which is, yes, you can be an advocate, like a developer advocate, but we all need to be an advocate at least for ourselves and share the great work that we're doing. So I think that's fantastic advice.
Nancy, what?
Yeah, and One thing I'll add to that is like when you say the great work that you're doing and building in public, like literally build in public and show your projects, put your projects out there. I think one of my very first LinkedIn posts was like, hey, I like created this little dashboard and I just wanted the world to see. And I think I got like 10 likes. But I also got great feedback on it. And people suggesting some changes that I could make. And at that time, I was just like such a sponge. And I was like, well, I didn't think of that. Like, thank you so much. And so putting yourself out there, like, yes, you could attract some like rejection, right? But you could also attract great feedback from people who genuinely want to help, because odds are those people at one point, they were going through this same dilemma. And so you'll meet a lot of friends and mentors who want to uplift you because they have gone through that vulnerable process as well. So it's like not just building your own personal brand, but like literally building projects and your skills, like put that out there in public and like document the whole thing. And you'll be so grateful that you did afterward.
As you look to the future, I know we're wrapping up at the end of the year here. What are you excited about most in 2024?
I am excited to give more talks. And so we had spoken because I had reached out to you for tips on how to do that. And like, it scares the hell out of me. But I made a post about this on LinkedIn the other day. It's like, I have this masochistic like thing where attacking the things that frighten me, it gives you such a rush because I know that the feeling that you'll get afterward is going to be so worth it. And so like, I have a couple talks scheduled for beginning half of next year. And like, thinking about it now, I'm just like, okay, I'm going to have to do a lot of work for this, especially if I follow all the tips that you gave me. But I know that afterward, I'm going to be so proud of myself for doing the thing that I previously thought I could never do. And so I'm just excited to like jump into the deep end and like scare myself a little bit for the next year. And for me, it's like public speaking is definitely that thing that scares me the most. But it's like a good type of nerves.
Well, I'm definitely excited for you. And I know I'm super proud of you for like jumping into something that scares you. I think that's always an area for all of us. So like we kind of stay away from those types of topics or things, right? And so to fully jump in it, to reach out to people and just know that I'll be here cheering you on and available if you ever need a chat. And everyone is going to be cheering you on in these talks. And I'm sure it's going to be a really wildly successful year. So excited to hear you on a big keynote stage here soon. Awesome. Well, I just want to say, I hope everybody checks out Megan's class. It's on LinkedIn Learning, SQL for Finance. And again, Megan, what's the best way for people to connect with you? Is it LinkedIn, Instagram? Where do you prefer people?
Yeah, I live, breathe, and eat LinkedIn. So you can find me there mostly. But I am also, as you know, Sadie, trying to like build up my Instagram and my TikTok. So if you find me there, it looks really pathetic right now, but we're trying to get that ball rolling. But my default is going to be LinkedIn.
Perfect. Well, we'll be sure to include your handles in the show notes, and I encourage everyone to follow Megan. Again, thank you, Megan, for coming on the show and taking the time. This has been a pleasure.
Thanks, Sadie. It was great being here.
And thanks to our listeners. Remember to stay curious and keep learning. And we'll catch you next time on the Data Bytes podcast. Goodbye, everybody. Thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of the Data Bytes podcast. If you're looking for more resources to further your data career or find your tribe, we encourage you to become a member at womenindata.org. See you on the other side.